the UCR Podcast.
As you would hope, we spend a lot of our days at UCR writing about our favorite music, but also talking about our favorite music. And it's gotten to the point where we have group text messages. And one of my favorite text threads is definitely the one that I have with my buddy Chuck Armstrong, where we talk about Pearl Jam, Metallica, probably other music too, but especially Pearl Jam and Metallica. Chuck is with me. And Chuck, we have a friend in our midst named Scott, who is one of these guys that periodically just reaches out to us. And in this case, he says, hey, would you like to do this? And he got in touch and pointed out that the 30th anniversary for Pearl Jam's Vitalogy was coming up. And would we be interested in doing something to celebrate the anniversary? Now, Chuck, I don't think he had any idea the Pearl Jam wormhole that he was opening up by sending that email to the two of us, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's very nice of him to reach out to us and to offer this up. And I don't think he was quite ready for our emphatic response to him to make this happen.
For sure, man. So our two brains definitely started racing as far as the possibilities of what we could do. Scott, he was already ahead of us. He told us that the guys from Pearl Jam would not be available because of the ongoing tour for Dark Matter. No problem, because we thought about a guy in the Pearl Jam camp that was there for the legendary Atlanta show in 94, the Soldier Field concert in 95, the Self-Pollution radio broadcast. These are all things that Pearl Jam nerds like us know about. And Brett Eliason has been working with Pearl Jam since July 4th, 1991, before their debut album 10 was even in stores. If we could get to him, Brett would be the guy who could share a lot of stories about the Vitalogy era. And huge thanks to Scott. He got us in touch with Brett. We had an awesome conversation. Before we get to the conversation, Chuck, I do want to find out for you, like, what was kind of your origin story with Pearl Jam? How did you find your way to the band's music?
You know, it's a good question, man. And I've been thinking about it just as we've been so deep into this. I was fortunate to grow up with a dad in particular who was and still is a huge music fan. And so, it wasn't an instance of like me stumbling onto 10 or Verses and, you know, having my mind blown. It was just sort of always there in some capacity. And so, like,
sure,
like we had 10 in our house and we had Verses in our house and we had Vitalogy in our house and we listened to them. And, but I will say for me, like where I felt coming into my own like fandom with Pearl Jam definitely was around Vitalogy, No Code, Yield, like those three albums for me. That's where I felt like I'm embracing this on my own, like without any influence or anything like that. Like these albums are totally changing my perspective on rock, on Pearl Jam, on what's possible, on, you know, the sound of the 90s, all of that. And then that just grew into an obsession. I unfortunately didn't get to see Pearl Jam in the 90s, but close. My first PJ show was in 2000 on the Binaural Tour. And just as you know, you would expect, just an absolutely epic show. Two or three encores. They ended with "Rockin' in the Free World," one of my all time favorite songs. And I mean, just an unforgettable night. And since then, have had the chance to see them in a number of different places and some pretty legendary venues, including the Apollo Theater in New York City, which will always kind of blow my mind that I got to witness that. But yeah, it's just it's sort of been a lifelong journey for me. And all the way through this year with Dark Matter, I mean, it's just a fandom that seems to grow and grow. And so, you know, getting to celebrate new music like Dark Matter is certainly a huge treat. But also, man, getting to talk to you and Brett and Scott and just everybody about the history of Pearl Jam, and in particular the anniversary of Vitalogy and everything, man, it's been a lot of fun.
I think that Scott connected some pretty important dots that, like, I hadn't thought about, and that was the fact that, like, basically Pearl Jam got nominated, I believe, for 3 Grammys for Vitalogy, and he pointed out that kind of full circle this year, as we know, Chuck, like, Pearl Jam got nominated for 3 Grammys for Dark Matter, so it's like they still have that relevance, which, like, when you're a band and you get X number of years into it, like, that's not guaranteed. So, like, I know as a fan, and I know you agree with this, like, it's just been pretty incredible to watch their path and watch how they just remain so in the middle of pop culture in the way that they do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a perfect way to put it. And you see that, you know, whether it's with Grammy nominations or with live shows. I mean, you know, they don't necessarily play a ton of shows, but when they do tour, I mean, those tickets are virtually impossible to get. You have to enter a lottery for even the chance to buy And if you're not lucky enough, man, like you're spending a ton of money on the, you know, second and third hand sites to try to be lucky enough to be inside that venue just to experience that live show from Pearl Jam. And that's true today. Like that's true in 2024, all these decades later. It's really amazing.
Well, I loved hearing you mention No Code, because one of the things I thought about a lot as we were starting to get ready to talk to Brett was just what a magical period it was for Pearl Jam, going from 10 to Versus to Vitalogy. Like, that's just a pretty magical trilogy. But I think what's magical about that for me is that with each one of those albums that followed 10, Versus, Vitalogy, like there's just this left turn that happens. And No Code was like another example of that. And I think you mentioned Yield as well. Like it, the same was true. Like, I think that's something that we started to see with Versus that continue with Vitalogy. And as we go through their entire catalog, something that became consistent with Pearl Jam was that they were not afraid to kind of rip up the playbook with every single album that they made. And that's something that has been really consistent throughout their career. And I think that after those first three albums, Chuck, when I got No Code, like that was like one of the first instances where I say first instances, but this happened like really with like each of those albums. But like that was one of the first instances where the band really blew my mind. And I kind of had that same feeling going back to Vitalogy, just thinking about how different that was in context to the two records that they had delivered prior to that. So it's kind of interesting 30 years on to make that kind of connection between Vitalogy and No Code. Just two albums that for me as a fan, I had never really connected them in that way, but those are two albums for me as a fan. They really just kind of knocked me back, and it took me a while to fully consider what I'd heard after the first time that I played through those two records.
Well, and you're right too, like in the moment, right, in 94 and 96, when you got Vitalogy and No Code, like you had that experience, but you're absolutely right. Like that sort of signaled this, this mindset of a band where they're not interested in trying to remake 10. You know, they're not interested in just fitting into any box or any formula. And I mean, yeah, you go down the discography from Vitalogy to No Code to Yield to Binaural to Riot Act, on and on, and up to Dark Matter this year. Like every album is absolutely its own album, stands apart from anything that preceded it, will stand apart from anything that follows it. And yeah, it is kind of interesting to see that, you know, maybe not officially start with Vitalogy as far as the band's concerned, but, you know, for listeners, for fans, like that is kind of the moment where you started realizing like, this is a different type of band and they're going to do what they want to do and they're going to make the album they want to make. And like you said, here we are all these years later and they're still so relevant, so much part of kind of the fabric of pop culture.
Before we dig into this chat with Brett, I just want to ask, like, for you as a fan, like, what did you love about getting to have this conversation with Brett?
Man, there were a couple of moments that really stood out to me, and, you know, I'll try not to spoil the upcoming conversation, but certainly hearing the memories of the early days. You know, you mentioned Brett started working with Pearl Jam in July of 91. Yeah, before 10 came out. And so he had some pretty amazing memories of touring with the band and some of their first live shows and just those experiences. And, you know, just to sort of be transported to that is pretty incredible. But also, and Brett gets into this, but a significant part of his own career and beyond Pearl Jam, but also his work with Pearl Jam, is the live side. And so, you know, for any, even a casual fan of Pearl Jam knows just how important the live album is. And, you know, I had mentioned my first show being in 2000. Well, that was the first tour that they released their official bootlegs of. And, you know, you could buy those bootleg CDs and everything. And Brett's had his hand in so many of those and in Live on Two Legs and Live on 10 Legs and their official live albums. And so to kind of get to hear him dive into that experience and what it's like, you know, the difference obviously between mixing a live album and a studio album, but also like for an album like Live on Two Legs, picking which songs make the album and who he's sitting in the room with listening to and how many shows he listened to find the right songs. It's just, you know, for a fan and for a nerd, I'm like, oh, that's just like the dream, you know, like, I mean, I just wish I could do that every day.
I want to give a quick shout out to that end to the guys from the State of Love and Trust podcast, because they go deep into the topic of the official bootlegs. And it was just, as you might imagine, although it just seems normal now, like it was an epic task to get the official bootlegs up and running. And like kind of the moment that really stuck with me when Brett told like the long story about how he did that when he was talking to those guys was that he had been talking to the band's manager, Kelly Curtis, and Kelly asked him, you know, can we mix the entire, you know, first leg of shows and how long is that going to take? And Brett said, we can do that in 2 weeks. So they did a couple of like kind of proof of concept gigs prior to that first leg of the tour. Brett goes in and mixes the first show, and it takes him 3 days to mix the first show. And he realizes that it's going to be more of a task than what he had promised Kelly. So sometime before that first leg begins, Kelly comes back to him. He's like, so we're going to be good, you know, after this is done, you know, you can mix this in 2 weeks. And Brett starts to say that, like, I think it's going to take longer. And Kelly says, yeah, but you said we could get it done in that amount of time. So Brett was like, he realizes in that moment that, like, I got to figure out how to get this done in the 2 weeks that I told Kelly I could get it done. So just an amazing anecdote. I think that's what people are going to enjoy about this conversation with Brett is, as you kind of said, man, like, he just has all sorts of stories like that. Like, so he's an amazing kind of just walking container of Pearl Jam lore. So it was just a real pleasure. We're going to get out of the way. That's all we need to say here. I will say, if you're listening to this, make sure to follow the podcast so you receive future episodes as they come out. Rate and review what we're doing here, wherever you're listening. We do appreciate it. And here's our conversation with longtime Pearl Jam associate, Brett Elias. We're here today to talk about the 30th anniversary of Pearl Jam's third record, Vitalogy, as well as a pretty cool thing that they did in the midst of the whole promotional cycle for the record, which, as the three of us know here, they do this live broadcast via satellite, which was carried on hundreds of stations called Self-Pollution Radio. Where I think we'd like to start is talking a little bit about your beginnings with Pearl Jam. Like, your first day on the job, I think, as it turns out, was July 4th, 1991, concert at Rock Candy there in Seattle, which is, for listeners to get the perspective, that's close to 2 months before 10 gets released on August 27th of that same year. But you go back further than that with Mike and Stone, right? So how did you come to know those guys?
It was more Jeff and Stone. When I started, so I did an internship during college for a studio in Seattle called Steve Lawson Productions. And then Steve, at the end of my internship, offered me a job. I went and started working there in, I don't know, 90 or 85 or so. And during that period, one of the first things I was involved with was Green River, working on Rehab Doll. Now, by involved, I mean, I went and got sandwiches, wrap cables back then. But I'd gotten to know the guys a little bit. And then you fast forward some more. They had come in to do some Mother Love Bone demos with Bruce Calder, and I was second engineering on that. Jeff was a Fleetfoot messenger at the time, bicycle messenger in Seattle. And so he used to deliver stuff to the studio. And there was a day where he came by and I was out front. I said hi and visited for a minute. And he said, hey, our new band's playing at the Off Ramp. You should come check us out. And that was like a Friday night or something like that. And so I did. I went and saw, you know, Mookie Blaylock play one of their first shows in Seattle. It was funny because brand new band, nervous, you know, everybody was kind of hiding, head down, looking at their amps a little bit. And then they went and played Alone, which was, I believe, written during the Mother Love Bone period. And all of a sudden, the room just lit up. And I looked up and went, wow, there's something here, right? There's a lot of energy. There's all of a sudden something that hadn't been there for the rest of that show, but they found their feet a little bit at that point. I was out doing some live recording for Andy and Nancy Wilson of Heart with a side project called The Lovemongers at the Ballard Baxter Tractor Tavern. Tractor Tavern. I'd gotten to know Kelly through Ann and Nance. They were old, longtime friends from their early childhood. And Kelly showed up as I was crossing the backstage area. He had Ed in tow, Ed Vedder. And we started chatting and he said, hey, you know Jeff and Stone's new project? I was like, yeah. He said, well, we're looking for someone to go do sound on the East Coast for the new music seminar, a few other things that were going on. Do you know of anybody? Well, I'd gone freelance from the studio, meant I wasn't making any money. And I thought about it. Yeah, I'll do it. And Kelly looked at me and said, I didn't know you did live sound. I'm like, how hard can it be, right? So my first show, yeah, the kind of tryout was the 4th of July. We had a really fun night that night. It was crazy. A good show. It wasn't much later that we loaded up a van and an equipment truck, and four of us drove those two things across the country to Boston, where we started. I think we played in the Avalon for a night of, you know, four or five bands, total throw and go. I was so nervous, like 1,000 people, and I'd never mixed in front of that many people before at that time. We did the China Club, I think, was in New York. And then we played the Wetlands, and there was a lot of record label folks there. Fun story that night, the band had gotten whisked away by the record company to go do some probably dinner and some chatting about business and whatnot. And house guy says, "Hey, it's you're up. Where's your band to get a line check done?" I was like, well, they're not here. And I said, I'd love to get drums set up. And I just jokingly yelled out, "Is there a drummer in the house?" And it turns out Masters of Reality were on that. And yeah, drummer stands up, and so Ginger stands up and says, "Will I do?" I said, "Yes, yes, that'll be great. Thank you."
Ginger Baker, no slosh yeah. there.
No, no, it worked out quite well. That was the first night they had. Matt Chamberlain was playing drums on that run. You know, great drummer, obviously. New to them. And that night, they just locked. You could, I mean, the energy in the room was palpable. Hair standing up in your arms. People were just in awe. Felt like a pallet of bricks just dropped on you. It was amazing. And that was really the first time that I saw that this band's going to blow up. There's just no two way around it. I think that venue's gone now, too, sadly. But so that's how we got going. I mean, we finished that up. We went across the upper Midwest, played the Metro. We played the First Ave to nobody. It was like 10 people in the place. We got added last minute to a Trip Shakespeare concert and then made our way home. And once we got home, we went right into the production and recording of the live show for the Alive video at the Rock Candy as well. And then they asked me if I wanted to continue. I was like, yeah, I see this thing having legs.
Did you guys hit it off pretty quickly? Like, you know, for them to ask you, do you want to continue? And then obviously all that came after that. You guys must have sort of connected pretty quickly.
Yeah, we did. Again, I knew Jeff and Stone fairly well. I had not met the rest of them at that point. Ed was a quiet guy back then. He took a little while to warm up to you, but once you do and you're in, right? Fierce and loyal friend. Mike's a sweetheart. I roomed with Stone and Mike, so we got to know each other pretty well during that phase of the career. But yeah, we did. Really, I mean, always been wonderful, gracious human beings. So how could you not like them?
You know, when, not to get ahead of Vitalogy, but when you were part of Mad Season, years later, Mike McCready in an interview said that they really wanted you to be part of that because you communicated in the same way. What did he mean by that?
I think just we fit each other in a way that there was, you didn't have to over discuss things, right? We just got in, we got going, and things flowed very naturally. That record came from, you know, a few live shows, making things up on the go, a lot of impromptu creativity went on, and you had to be in front of that and ready for it. But we all just, you know, we fit as human beings together. Everyone got along really, really well. And creatively, there was a lot of momentum. And I suppose, you know, my personality and the way I work helped that flow as well.
I think fans of just all the music that was happening at that time, like obviously that Mad Season project brought together a lot of things that people already loved. You know, I mean, Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam, we could just keep going down the line. Like, you know, what was the general vibe for you working on that whole project?
I was excited. I mean, I had gone to see them. I was working on something else at, I suppose that was then called Studio X. They were playing the Crocodile Cafe, which is just a couple blocks away. So I walked over to watch that show that night, and it was being recorded as well. And afterward, Mike just took me aside and said, "Hey, you want to come in and make some demos with us?" I was like, "Absolutely." And not unlike their 10 project and many other things those guys have done, we got in, started making it, and then it just became a record, right? Which was nice. I mean, we were on our own schedule. It wasn't any pressure. it was just something that came together naturally, and we were able to complete it and then offer it to the record label.
What I'll say is that, like, I think that what you described with Bad Season, what I kind of like about that is that kind of ties in with the Vitalogy period, really what was going on with those first like three records and, you know, Self-Pollution Radio. Like, it just seems like there was kind of that free form spirit that really helped to contribute a lot of important kind of good juju to the things that Pearl Jam was doing in this whole period.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I worked on the Brad record with Stone as well, just a little bit before that period. I was probably involved with Jeff and Three Fish around that era. You know, those guys are so creative and such amazing writers, and not everything they do fits the Pearl Jam vibe. So they have a lot of fun taking that creativity and, you know, being able to grow the other things that don't belong to Pearl Jam, being able to expand on those processes and, you know, putting out really cool, interesting records that way too. But that was going, that had really started to come together during that era where everybody was comfortable with each other doing that kind of thing, right? It's not an affront to the band. It's obviously just another creative outlet for people. You know, not that far after that, we also did the record with Neil Young, was sort of right on the heels of that era as well, which was an incredible experience.
Yeah, for sure, man. We want to talk about that for sure. I'm going to like pull us back a little bit. As the story goes, like, the band was working on material for Vitalogy while they're touring. So, you know, what we see from the set list is that you were constantly hearing new songs in that time period. Can you kind of take us back a bit from your view to how you kind of saw the songs for Vitalogy coming together in front of you in that way?
They were rehearsing a lot during sound checks. Some of that stuff was debuted, if I remember right. It's been a while. They were going into places like, it's the Kingsway down in New Orleans and, you know, a place up in upper Midwest. I'm pretty sure probably we're working with Brendan. We probably went into the studio in Atlanta. So, yeah, there was, you know, it was an interesting thing where instead of being a cohesive group at the studio and just focusing on a record, it was something that was coming together more naturally from a touring experience. From one of the things that Kelly Curtis, their manager, used to do with them and with others was before you even went in to make a record, he'd ask them to go do a tour, even if it was just a handful of shows. And it made a lot of sense. When you play those things live, you vet them. You work out some bugs, you find that natural live energy behind it as well, right? And so Vitalogy was steeped in that. And they were doing a lot of playing in the room together with just monitors around them, sort of really live performances in the studio and that kind of thing. And that adds a different dimension, an exciting dimension to it as well.
You know, you're talking about that era and kind of the guys, you know, maybe finding different sounds or different things they wanted to do outside of Pearl Jam. I mean, you obviously knew the band very well, became very familiar with them through those first two albums. And then Vitalogy, you know, it's different. It's eclectic, some might say. But is that sort of, did you kind of see the members growing and maybe as they were thinking about things outside of the band, still kind of bringing some of that into the band too, that led to Vitalogy?
Absolutely. One of the biggest changes there was Ed picked up his guitar and started playing with the band, right? That was a huge change right there. And some of the amazing songs on Vitalogy were Ed writing and playing, for sure. So he got comfortable enough and confident enough that he decided to bring that. And the other thing that's interesting about Ed and the guitar is that he has a internal rhythm, right? His vocal canter, things like that, you know, you hear in the melody, the vocal melody. But if you pay attention to his right hand on the guitar, it really follows that and sets the tone for that. Nobody else plays like that. So it adds this really neat rhythmic factor that the other guys, you know, aren't in his head and can't emulate at all. So that alone was a big change some growth in the band. They also were a lot more confident by that point. I mean, you know, coming into Verses after how well 10 did, they were nervous. You know, it's a sophomore record. What are we going to do? How's this going to go, right? Went all right. But I don't think there was as much of that nerves and angst coming into Vitalogy. I think there was they were a very cohesive group by this point. They've done a lot of shows by that point, gotten to know each other really well. Abrazis had been with the band for a couple of years at that point and was settled in. There are a lot of different chemical components that help pull it all together. Musically, yeah, I mean, I think everybody had gotten comfortable with just throwing the door open and letting people bring in whatever they wanted to, and then the band would vet it. And, you know, everyone had to realize that their precious song was going to go into the grinder with everybody, right? Everybody's going to change things up a little bit, and they're going to make it theirs, which makes it Pearl Jam. You know, it wasn't so much just Jeff and Stone writing everything as, you know, Mike and Ed were contributing as well.
Which is really interesting to hear because, yeah, the Pearl Jam we know and love today, you know, 30 years later, that all makes total sense. But to think about, yeah, 10 and Versus maybe not carrying that sort of whatever, that collaboration with it, and then it really coming into it with Vitology. I didn't realize that was, you know, really the first time that Eddie would start writing while playing guitar.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously could play guitar and he wrote songs.
Right.
But the first record, you know, the vast majority of that, the musically is Jeff and Stone, with Ed, of course, lyrics and melodies and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think he really wanted to feel like he was more involved as well with that, you know, and feel more inspired being allowed to add more to the creative process. And, you know, of course, everyone embraced that and it's gone pretty well since then.
And there's that piece on the album, you know, that, like, I know that, you know, Jack Irons plays drums and, you know, you're kind of the one that, you know, came in and, you know, engineered that particular thing. Like, that's a really eclectic, like, 7.5 minutes on the record. Like, there's just some fascinating stuff on Vitology. Like, it must have been just pretty fascinating for you to be in the midst of all that.
It was. That particular cut, Ed had, I don't know how he had come upon that individual and that recording, but I was out. Stone had a home in Seattle, and before he owned his recording studio, he had a big basement, and that was part of the parameters for the home he wanted. He wanted a big basement with high ceilings so he could put a studio in there. And we'd been working on something, and Ed showed up, had this cassette of the gal saying, you know, the Foxy Ma panel and all her parts. And then we had Jack play drums to it. Edited things up a little bit. I did a quick mix there and it went great. Took it back to the studio and handed it to Brendan and said, this is going on there.
Yeah, I like that. That's kind of like the democracy in that time that you could just basically bring that in, or, you know, and as we know, it happened with the other band members too. As you said, like, people had to get used to their stuff going into the grinder and maybe it doesn't come back out. But I just liked that that democracy was so free-flowing that even somebody like you could kind of like bring something to the table and say, man, I think this needs to go on the record.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What do you think even with songs like Bugs and some of the other things? I mean, initially, you know, everything had to be very serious. And it wasn't until I think Rats maybe is the first song that Ed put lyrics to that weren't pretty intense, right? They're a little lighter, a little... had a little sense of humor, a little tongue in cheek, and that was good to see as well.
Let's get into Self-Pollution Radio. Like, Eddie had done some pirate radio type stuff, including a broadcast following the Atlanta show in 94. As we know, like, he did something similar after Self-Pollution Radio with the Chicago show in 95, but logistically, in the middle of that, like, I'm curious, like, what it was like putting Self-Pollution Radio together, because listening to the broadcast now, like, I'd forgotten that Eddie and the band guys had kind of a DJ set up in one area and then the bands were setting up and playing in another area. Like, so what do you recall about how you guys landed on the location where you did it, and what was it like pulling it off? Because it seems like there could have been and must have been some chaotic moments.
Definitely. So the Atlanta, that was Fox Theater, and, you know, it was a live show with a FNL recording track, right? Same thing at another Fox Theater, and they did do some stuff out of a van with an actual pirate radio setup, and I would give them a front of house stream, and that would go over the air, and they'd do some DJing. Ed would get in the van and talk to people, that kind of stuff. So he had a taste for it and loved the freedom of that, and that's kind of where that was all spawned from. Ed had originally had an apartment in Seattle that he would go to write and just kind of get away. And occasionally it was a little kind of hang pad with friends and things like that. Neighbors were complaining about noise when he'd be in there playing guitar or whatever. So he let that lease, actually, before he let that lease go, he let the phone number to that apartment out. And on the air at Self Pollution Radio and said, hey, call me, just so the phone would ring 24/7 and annoy those people that had gotten him in trouble. But anyway, so he had rented this little house on Aurora Avenue, just north of Seattle. These days, that particular is not bad. But you go a little further north and it's a bit of a sketchy part of town, right off Aurora. Had a big green belt going up the hill behind it. And again, it was his place to go write if he had the muse, a place to take friends if they were getting crazy and not take it home, whatever, have a fun night. He came up with the idea of doing this radio broadcast from this little house. It had a bit of a backyard and they put a little cover over the patio in the back, not a big house. Next door was fenced property that had belonged to some folks that he didn't really care for. It was chained and locked. So to add to the pirate effect, we had to cut the locks, open that up, pulled two huge tractor trailers in with very large satellite dishes, one as a backup, one as your main uplink. We had a remote truck out there, recording truck for me. We had another vehicle out there full of the DJ gear and interview stuff. Telephones for call-ins, things like that. And my old friend, Sonny Felberg, actually ran that for us. He had been in studio and then moved into a radio broadcast for a while, so he knew his way around that stuff. We had a green room trailer out on that property, so guests could have a place to go sit, have a beverage, and get out of the way. And then, of course, you had Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Mad Season, Fastbacks, and Mudhoney. Playing that day, you know, setting it up. There was one bedroom, small. I mean, you were talking like 12 by 12, maybe. And we put monitors in there. The band stuffed themselves in there with little setups. And that was the band room. And then you had kind of the living room area, kitchen where people were hanging out. Most people were staying out back. It was a decent day out. So they were outside. And of course, it was catered and there were some beverages around and that kind of thing. So really fun atmosphere. I mean, everybody was just communal and having a great time all day. It didn't really dawn on me. I mean, just business as usual, getting set up, getting things ready to go. And then a buddy of mine who was there, worked with Mudhoney, looks at me and goes, I heard this is going up to 6 million people. What do you think about that? And suddenly my hands were shaking and I get a little sweaty, but it worked. It went very well. It was fun.
Well, you know, I'm curious as you talk about that, you know, hearing like, oh, 6 million people, and you get a little more nervous, you know, for fans of Pearl Jam. We could spend all day talking about studio albums, but just as significant are live albums. And, you know, you've had your hands in bootlegs and the official live albums and all of that. I mean, what's it like mixing a live album compared to what you've done with like Vitalogy or prior?
Studio is definitely a different world. You know, you're creating in the room. It takes sometimes weeks, months, depending on who you're working with and how they like to work. When you get to the mixing stage of that, that stuff is much more fleeced out, right? It's, you know, you've been looking towards the end process the whole time you're recording, producing, getting it ready. Live stuff, it's a matter of finding the right performances with the right energy, hopefully not many mistakes, easily repaired stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's more work getting everything prepped, meaning depending on where the recording came from, levels can be a little off, right? You're dealing with room mics and audience, which is a huge part of it. I think that's one of the things that benefits me from my live experience is that I've had to tune rooms for live shows, right? I have to make the PA sound good in that room, and I know how to deal with room harmonics and low-end buildup and all that kind of thing. But that can beat you. You need the ambience. You need the crowd presence in there. Obviously, that's a lot of the excitement. But it can also swallow up your mix if you're not treating it right. So there's that. But, you know, for me, I kind of my mixing career now is 90-95% mixing live performances for people. And I love it. I mean, I just love that energy, the immediacy of it, the outcome of it when it all comes together and it feels like you're sitting immersed in a live show, all that energy that's involved. I don't think that exists on records as much, and certainly not with modern production. You know, there's more flaw there. There's that push and pull between human beings, and it just feels more natural.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And that's why no matter how many bootlegs Pearl Jam releases, I love listening to all of them because you'll hear different things, even if it's the exact same song or whatever, you'll hear those different things come out. You know, on an album like Live on Two Legs or Live on 10 Legs, were you part of picking the performances? I mean, you mentioned you got to find the right performance. Were you part of those conversations like,
absolutely,
let's do this one, let's,
Live on Two Legs, I had 40 shows to comb through. I literally sat in my living room in headphones with a DAT player, went through every show and made a binder of handwritten notes and started to call what I wanted out of that. Stone was, the guys will trade off who oversees certain projects depending on their availability and interest. Stone oversaw that one with me. Jeff came in as well. But so I had made a bunch of notes and we just started pulling songs. I just started mixing over a few weeks and then we started to figure out what was working, what wasn't, starting to come together with a concept of a track listing that would make it feel natural. Taking individual songs from 40 different shows. There were a few shows that a lot of them came from just because they were special shows. But as you start to call it, pull it together, trying to make it sound like one show and flow seamlessly, it's a fun process. It's the first time I'd done it that way before. And really pleased with the outcome of that. And Live on 10 Legs, there was a few of us that went through the tracks, but ultimately I helped vet them. And then of course, the band has to okay everything as it goes. So.
And we could certainly go for the live shows for quite a while, but you mentioned Neil Young earlier and I'd wanted to ask about that because like, that seems like that could have been an experience where you find yourself in the room with Neil Young that could be overwhelming. Like that's where like, you know, the stuff like the imposter syndrome starts to creep in. So I like wondered how that experience was for you.
That's a great question and very, very true. We had played Constitution Hall in DC for Gloria Steinem's Vote for Choice. And Neil and Crazy Horse had joined us on that. Pearl Jam was last. Neil had done his set. He had some new songs he'd been working on. He was so blown away by the energy of Pearl Jam that night that he asked if they would do an encore with him and play one of the songs that was going to be coming up from, or two of the songs, I think, that were coming up from, that became part of Mirrorball. They learned him backstage, went out, and it was great. And he just loved that whole thing and wanted to be immersed in it and asked him if they'd make a record with him and said, I want this to be very Pearl Jam centric. I want to, you know, do this with you guys in Seattle. I want your crew around. I want your management around. I just want that whole thing right now. So we met up in Studio X in Seattle. We had set up, we brought this huge rug from the rehearsal space to lay down. We set up couches and lamps and made this large room super homey, made it, you know, like a big living room. And then set the band up kind of in a semicircle with, it was live monitors, side fills. It was kind of very similar to a stage setup, but so they could play live together out there. And that's what they did. We'd go until they captured what they wanted as a bass. We might throw, that was it, right? There was no really fixing unless it was such a great take. There was one little thing over here that needed to be repaired. We just punch it in and, you know, fix it up. Maybe lead overdubs. Neil would double his voice a bit, but even his vocal was being laid down at the same time the band was playing and he was playing guitar. It was just magical. But I got there at 7 o'clock in the morning. Brendan O'Brien was producing. We got everything set up, myself and the band crew. By the time Brendan showed up, we were ready to go. We got recording pretty quick. I think it took 20 minutes of kind of futzing around. And then, you know, everybody's like, okay, we're good. Let's go. And yeah, at that moment, because I was just so, you know, head down, getting things ready, excited about this, wanted to make sure it flowed super smoothly. It's a lot to put together in just a couple of hours. And then Neil walked in and I looked up, went, oh Christ, that's Neil Young. You know, one of my favorite live records was his back in the day. So, and a cool man. I mean, fortunate enough to have gotten to know him a bit. So really cool guy, but what a fun process. Amazing energy. You know, we did, few days worth of recording, and then the band had a live obligation in Montana that we were going to go do. So we had to tear down. We went and did that, came back and had to set everything back up and finish up, but that worked out great. And the majority of that record was just the board mixes that were up. That's Neil. Neil's just, if it was feeling right at the time, it's done. I love that about him. He doesn't overthink things. It's just all, you know, if I felt really great while that was happening and when I came in to listen to it and it captured what I was after, we're done. And so probably 90-95% were just the rough mixes that were up on the console between, you know, Brendan and myself. So
as those records, as Mirrorball and Merkinball turned 30 this coming year, I think fans are curious, like, how much is there, like, as far as stuff we haven't heard?
From that, that pretty much got out. We did record a live show at Moe's up on Capitol Hill in Seattle. And that was the first time that they had played this record together. Those tapes are somewhere. That's never come out. So that would be fun because it was a good show. That would be fun to find and make happen. I'd forgotten all about that. Merkinball was a little different in that Ed really wasn't around for these sessions because Neil was singing and it was the band. And he was going through some issues with a stalker, kind of his first real serious kind of scares with regards to fame. And a lot of people don't understand that. It's not a blessing always. And he had written these two songs. He lost a friend of his. So The Long Road was about that. And I Got ID was about the other. And he popped in and, you know, towards the end of the night and said, hey, can we lay something down? Absolutely. One of those has Brendan on bass because Jeff had already gone home. So it's just sort of whoever was there put it together. And then we tracked the vocals right on the tail of it. So again, it was still this live setup and everybody playing together. And then Ed would throw a vocal over it and that was done. Both those songs. And Neil played on both of them, I think. Guitar on one, and I think he played guitar on both of them, but definitely he also played pump organ on Long Road, which, what a beautiful song. Again, that's something, I mean, just to be a fly on the wall and watch that come together, right? It's incredible.
Any plans for a reissue on that next year?
Not that
the,
I know.
You know, the original vinyl copy, it's a little hard to find out there.
Yeah. I've heard that Neil's been talking about it, but I don't know.
All right.
They don't ask me much.
I won't hold you to that. Listen, last question. Just to wrap this up, man, I mean, spending all this time looking back and, you know, 30 years of Vitology, what's one of your favorite memories from that time?
I don't know if I have one. I mean, I was so fortunate to have been able to just luck out and jump into that wave. And by that era, it was really cresting. So we were at a point there where the whole thing was hitting on all cylinders. Everybody was having a great time. Band and crew were family, you know. I mean, we've lost a couple along the way, but I'm still in touch with all those people, you know. I miss them all dearly when I don't get to see them or talk to them for a while. And that for me is really so much of it. Touring is not fun most of the time. It's a lot of work. It's not glamorous. It's living in the dirt, showering in dressing rooms or locker rooms. You know, you get hotels, sure, especially later on when you're doing better. But early on, I mean, yeah, taking baths and club sinks. But what makes it special, one is the music and the band. When they're great, that's a wonderful. But that's, you know, a couple hours out of your day. The rest of the time, it's the people you're with. And if you all get along and we had a really special relationship together, that is what made me keep coming back and just having a blast.
Man, this was a lot of fun. So thank you so much for taking the time, Brett. Like, we really appreciate you spending some time going through some memories with us here.
Thank you. It's fun to kind of look back when they first told me that this is what you want to do. I thought, oh boy, I hope I remember any of it. It's been a minute. But thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
There you have it. Another episode of the UCR Podcast is in the books. I am Matt Wardlaw. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please make sure to follow this podcast if you haven't, so you will get future episodes as they're released. And we'd appreciate it also if you would rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. Look, we are all music fans, so if you enjoyed this, you can find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, and we'll see you there.